Welcome to Paper Cuts Podcast, because YA needs to hear this. I'm Ollie from New Jersey.
I'm Robin from Idaho.
And I'm Senna from Ohio.
Today we're here with Ellen Hopkins, author of the upcoming YA contemporary novel, Smoke. Hi, Robin. Hi, Senna.
Hi, Ollie.
Hi, Ollie.
I'm excited you can join me today.
I'm so excited to be out of my box.
You better behave, or we're going to put you back in.
No!
Well, this is our 11th podcast, right?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. We have finally made the 11th podcast. And this is the first time we are all going to chat with an author together and actually have it record.
Fingers crossed.
Totally cross. So, shall we jump into it?
Sounds good.
Excellent. We have on the line with us Ellen Hopkins. As I mentioned before, she's the author of the upcoming young adult contemporary novel, Smoke. Ellen, welcome to Paper Cuts Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So, for those unfamiliar with your work, new readers will first notice how your stories are told in verse. What has been the most challenging part of this format? What has been the most rewarding? And were you a poet first, or did the books develop and push for such unique presentation?
I was a poet first. I've been writing poetry since I was about 9 years old, and growing up with a poetry group in Carson City for about 20 years. So I write... What I write in my books would be narrative verse, so verse that tells a story, right? But it's not necessarily, it's not rhymed. Sometimes I rhyme, usually not. It's not lyric poetry. It's not, you know, it's not formal poetry except for once in a while, you know, because I play with that stuff too, but it's narrative verse. So, you know, if you think about Homer or Joyce or, you know, some of those kind of ancient storytellers, like that, only not like that. probably what's hardest is, I don't know if it's hardest, it's most challenging, is to really make every word count, which is what poetry does anyway. So I'm taking out descriptions maybe and letting readers fill in some of those descriptors for themselves, which I actually think makes for a better book anyway. You know, I mean, I don't go through 5-page descriptions of Bougainvillea and New Orleans or something, you know, a la Anne Rice or anything like that. So that's a challenge. And it's also a challenge because I will have people who are poets who will say there's not enough poetry in what she writes. Or there'll be people who are on the other side that say there's too much poetry in what she writes. So it's building this audience. Although, you know, I mean, at this point, I have built quite a significant audience, and they love what I do. And so they love what I do, and that's what's most rewarding, is that people who might not be as good a readers or are maybe more challenged by a lot of words on the page are very drawn to what I do, because it's comfortable for them to read with fewer words on the page. And that's, so I'm bringing reluctant readers or often non-readers to books, and then once they figure out that they really actually like what books can do, then they'll go on and, you know, read other books as well.
I would imagine that also, since so many teenagers write their own poetry, that it reflects sort of their own lives as well in that kind of way.
Right, I think so. You know, because poetry is very interior. And teens tend to be kind of interior, right? It's all about kind of really discovering who they are. So it's inside them, and poetry is that. And that's why I think they enjoy writing it as well.
Yeah.
Robin, did you want to ask the second question?
Sure. At Paper Cuts, we're fascinated by the tropes used and subverted in YA novels. As an author who continually pushes the boundaries of contemporary YA, what tropes did you actively seek to avoid, subvert, or embrace with your new novel, Smoke?
First of all, Smoke is a sequel, right? And so it's a sequel to my second novel. So this is a book that's 6 years beyond the first, which is, that's unusual, right? And so because Burned, which was the first book, it had a religious framework. So there were, some of the pushback came from people who objected to that religious framework. And I actually would have tried to push away from that a little bit more, but my editor wouldn't let me. She's like, this is what the story is. You can't. In fact, she made me put in more. Some of the doctrine and put that back in for people that maybe might not have read the first book, but still need to understand what I'm talking about in the second. Mm. And this book, I would say, I mean, I've pushed a lot of boundaries with some of my books, you know, writing teen prostitution or childhood sexual abuse. Those push a lot of boundaries, obviously sexual boundaries or whatever. This book is probably the cleanest book I've written. And that is because the two characters, so they're sisters, right? And they, neither girl is in a place in their life where they are actively seeking a sexual relationship with a boyfriend. In fact, you know, they're pushing back against even having the boyfriend. And so, of course, they find them, whether they like it or not. But, you know, I guess I'm changing my own work up in a way. And I like that. I like not being too obvious or doing the same stuff over and over, you know? Yeah. So that was fun for me.
So it's almost like you subverted yourself.
Right. I do that regularly.
When you said you got a pushback about the religious aspect, was that people who felt that there was like too much of the religion, or people who felt that it was depicted like badly, or?
Right. Well, and the religion in the book is the Mormon religion, so LDS.
Yes.
And that is because we have a heavy, heavy LDS presence where I live in northern Nevada, especially in this little valley I live. So the Patton, the main character in Burn and in Smoke, I mean, she really resembles a girl who was my daughter's best friend for a long time. Mm-hmm. So in observing her family, which is probably not at all representative of a lot of Mormon families, you know, she was just influential into the writing of this character. And so the family in Burn is not a representative LDS family either. The father's an alcoholic and he's abusive, and that is not representative. So what they missed in that is that this girl, the way she looks at her church and kind of the patriarchal push of the church, which it does have, because her father was so overbearing, she saw that as an offshoot of her church. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't. It was his own experience. And so it depends on the reader, how the reader comes into the story,
mm-hmm.
how offended they were. But, you know, I can tell you the doctrine and all that is highly, highly researched. I have Mormon friends. I have Mormon ex-Mormon friends. You know, so it's not something that I just put out there to, like, I wasn't trying to slam the LDS religion at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was never about that.
Characters have their own histories and people have their own histories, which that seems to reflect really well the idea of if the father is an alcoholic and abusive, that's just possibly him and not necessarily the religion. So I like that angle.
That's the same as, like, you know, not all Catholic priests are pedophiles, but someone, you know what I mean? So if you're writing that priest, that's not saying that all priests are bad.
Right, it's that character's interaction with such a priest.
Hmm. That's right.
All right. So in your acknowledgments for Smoke, you mentioned that Patton deserves closure. What specifically brought you back to complete it? And had you ever considered, while you were writing Burned, that there was going to be more to the story?
Absolutely not. I have never started a book ever expecting there would be a sequel or looking forward to a possible sequel, and that includes Crank. So it just, within sometimes, with Burn specifically, it was, you know, I left her in this place. It was very open-ended ending. And, I mean, over the years I've had, I mean, thousands of readers come to me and go, I need to know what happens next. You know, and I will say, too, that having that be my second book, I was a fairly new author, and I was learning what an audience likes or what's fair for my readers, you know, as a newer writer then. And so my idea that I could just leave it open and let readers decide for themselves, maybe that's fair, maybe not, I don't know, but eventually it's just like, okay, you know what? I will tell you what happens next, because they just really, really wanted that. So I did that for my readers.
That's great.
How was it as a writer to return to a character that was last seen so long ago, 7 years? What was easy about that? What was difficult?
there, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I kind of did the same thing with Impulse and then with Perfect last year, so, you know, not quite as far apart. But the biggest challenge is remembering what was happening six, and actually when I wrote Burn, it was, you know, a year before that, what was happening politically or, you know, in the development of our country or, you know, like gay marriage was a bigger issue then than it is now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it still is, but not the same way. So a lot has happened to change the landscape of the U.S. people and how we live and how we think. So there are those challenges. And then I had to go back because kind of over the years, my characters are becoming older. She was younger, so I had to go back to kind of a different place with her. What's it like to be 17 instead of 19 or whatever? And there is quite a big difference in those 2 years, you know, because you're still in school and you're trying to deal with that stuff. She changed a lot, though, with what happened in that book. And so she is not the same person that she is through most of Burn. She's pretty damaged at the end of that book. And so to try to find a way to get her past that damage, that was difficult. You know, I wanted her to have a chance at a new relationship. And it was so close to what happened with her boyfriend in Burn. You know, it's like a 4-month time period between what happened with Ethan and, you know, where this book starts. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty close to being hurt that deeply. So, you know, all that kind of had to go into how I built her character moving forward. You know, she was a different person. And so I had to remember that as I moved her forward.
It sounds daunting.
Well, you tackle plot lines about abuse, rape, faith, mental illness, drug use, pretty much the whole gamut. What draws you to write for characters who deal with these hard-hitting topics?
Because not enough people do, I guess. And not enough people do honestly, I think. I think, you know, they'll skirt them a little bit. They'll write about them. They'll look at cutting. You don't see a lot of books that really go into the psychology of cutting or to the psychology of abuse and what happens on the far side of that. I think it's really important because these topics are, I mean, they're happening every day. They're touching teen lives every single day. Mm-hmm. And so I want a couple of things. I think by kind of shining the spotlight on some of that stuff, we a lot of parents don't want to believe it's happening to their children or other children, and it is. And so we shine the spotlight, so we show you what a possible victim looks like, what a possible perpetrator looks like. And also, I'm hopeful that young people who are being abused or know they have an eating disorder or know they have a cutting problem will be encouraged to step up and ask for help. Because I think, you know, there's been this stigma against those things. And to know that they're not alone in them, that there are other people going through them, and that those people do better when they ask for help sooner rather than later, they do so much better. And I think it's important that we talk about it and take the stigma off and try to develop understanding of the people that are doing them, and empathy from the people that aren't, you know, that maybe they will be able to tell their friend they need help.
I definitely agree. There's not enough actual presentation of teenagers with dealing with abuse or mental illnesses. We get a lot of really Hollywood versions, which even those end up kind of cleaned up, that it's really just awesome to have more authors and authors like yourself writing and showing the different faces of what, you know, your friend might be going through, what you might be going through.
Right, and it's important. I mean, I've always had really great support from my publisher, you know, or my editor, my publisher through my editor or whatever. I've never had them tell me I had to take something out of a book, not once.
That's awesome.
And I push, you know, like I said, I push some envelopes, and sometimes they'll actually encourage me to go as far as they think I really reasonably can within the YA, you know, genre. And I do that because I don't know, I just think kids have sex, and sometimes they have sex that we're not expecting them to have, you know, different things of sex. I mean, it's such a time of your life when you're experimenting and finding your way into what's okay and what's not okay. And some of the taboo stuff actually is that young people will experiment with to see if that will suit them or not. And, you know, maybe a book is a better place to explore that than actually out and trying it, maybe.
It's really great that you have such support from your publisher. I know we hear a lot about publishers kind of getting shy about what they think will or won't sell and what's appropriate for a YA book. So it's really great that your publishers are like, go for it, whatever you want to do.
And I would say the same thing with librarians. I got more pushback earlier, you know, but we've had a newer crop of librarians come through, and they feel the same way. And so I have a lot of library support. Most of my books are available in most school libraries, and they will push to keep them there. And I think it's important that they're available.
Yeah. I would imagine that there's probably plenty of non-understanding adults in communities who might look at it and go, oh my God, why is this here? And try to get them banned.
Censorship is a big thing. You know, it's a big part of my career. And pushing back against censorship is a big part of my career, too.
That's great that you've got that kind of support. I know there was a big kind of a public outcry. I think it was last year or the year before when there was, I believe it was an article or someone was calling Laurie Hall Sanderson's book Speak child pornography. And that's just the kind of mindset that gets really important books like yours and like Speak taken out of the reach of people who need them. It's just, it's really awful.
Right. And, you know, and I would ask, like, in fact, there was one just recently. It was within the last 2 weeks, maybe. It was also Speak.
Yeah.
You know, and to call Speak pornography, I would have to say pornography is materials designed to turn you on, right? Mm-hmm. So I would ask that man, if he's considering that pornography, why does that turn him on? Why does a rape scene in a book turn him on? He's the one with the problem.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not even, I remember reading Speak when I was pretty young, and it's not even, I mean, there's no, like, sexualized, it's not.
It's not sexy.
No, it's not in any way intended to portray that in any kind of beneficial light. So I guess just talking about it somehow makes it inappropriate for children, right? Because people who've actually experienced that, you know, they wouldn't want their mindset stained by such a horrible thing, right?
But you know what? I think for the most part, I think parents that challenge books or adults that challenge books, I think most of them come from a place of wanting, they want their children not to be exposed to things. Mm-hmm. And it's like, but they're, if they're being exposed in real life, see, what you should be offended by is that these things happen. Not that people write about them, but they happen. And the more we talk about them, maybe we can change those statistics, you know, and the statistics are huge. It's, you know, I chose teen prostitution because I came across the statistic that the average age of a female prostitute in the U.S. is 12 years old. Ugh. And that is true. And that comes from trafficking children. That's what skews that down. Mm-hmm. But right now, they just did an expose here in Reno. They interviewed young people, young prostitutes on the street who were being trafficked. So, you know, like pimps bring them in, 12, 13, 14 years old, the girls that they interviewed here. So in places like Vegas or, you know, big cities like New York or L.A. or San Francisco, you know, those statistics climb really rapidly.
Yeah. You know, people like to think that that doesn't happen here, but it's just not in your face, that's all.
Right. And if you don't look at it, then you can pretend it's not happening.
No, mm-hmm. Exactly. It's like I kind of amused by the people who think that they can keep this kind of thing from their children by keeping a book out of their hands. It's like, if you want to keep your child from that, then you need to keep them locked in the room for the rest of their life, because it's not like they're not being exposed to these kinds of things already.
And the way to protect them from that is to give them the knowledge they need,
right,
not to end up there, not to be pregnant, you know, not to get STDs. And that is by giving them education and knowledge, not by trying to, like, hide those. Now, the books that represent that stuff, that's not the way to protect them. It really isn't.
Right.
Absolutely.
Nothing was ever solved by putting your hands over your ears and, you know, pretending it doesn't exist. So you've been publishing since 2004 when Crank hit the scene. How has the YA world changed or stayed the same since then? And what were some of the challenges of bringing your first YA novel to publication?
YA was just starting that big renaissance when, and you know what, I never planned on writing YA. I was writing some adult stuff. I was writing journalistically. I was writing nonfiction. I thought I was going to write picture books. That was kind of it. I know I'm not really a picture book author at all. I found that out after writing several picture books. So, I mean, Crank, because it was a personal story, right? So it's my daughter's story, basically, or quite, you know, inspired by my daughter's story. Mm-hmm. I knew it had to be for teens because I wanted them to understand how quickly this could happen. You know, it was just important to me to tell it there. And then I'm like, whoa, okay, this is where I belong as a writer. So I came to it the back door, in through the back door, really. But, you know, I mean, YA was just starting that big swing. There was some good YA out. You know, Laurie was writing, mm-hmm. Chris Crutcher was writing, but it hadn't really, you know, people were still trying to figure out what YA was. Before that, it was kind of young adult used to mean pretty much what middle grade does now, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it started to push up, and we started to see a need for books that related just teens, right? And so in kind of this older teen place. As far as getting Crank published, I mean, the story goes, and it's true, that I sat down at a writer's conference with an editor from Simon & Schuster. I showed her a picture book, and she's like, this is really good writing, but I don't do picture books. Do you have anything else? And I had 10 pages of Crank written, and I showed that to her, and she said, send it to me when it's done.
Wow.
2 months later, I had 75 pages written. I emailed her and asked her if she would like an exclusive first look. She said yes. They sent me a contract to finish the book.
Wow.
So she knew that meth was a growing problem. She liked my writing. She knew it was going to be a powerful story. You know, nobody knew it was going to end up being a giant bestseller because you don't, you know, there's no way you can predict those things. Mm-hmm. But she was really savvy editor and saw the potential in what she saw in really 10 pages of that book.
Wow, that was awesome to just have an editor really click with a story like that.
And so, and that's where my whole kind of support system started. So she edited my first 3 books, then she moved to Houghton Mifflin, and my next editor who was publisher at MacIlderry and Athenaeum Books then, she was just as, maybe even more supportive because she had even more power that, you know, within that company at the time than the other editor did. So again, you know, just never, both those two editors have helped me grow my career. And then it was the readers who found my books.
Yeah.
And they embraced them and they love them. And so there it is.
You said that in 2004, YA was sort of skewing older. Do you think that was part of why Crank was so important? And do you think, like, now that it would be kind of the same situation getting something with such, I guess, like, controversial subject matter, getting that published in this market?
It's interesting because, I mean, I hear people say that they've been asked to dial it back or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then I hear people say, you know, the other. I think it's just, it's all very subjective. It's what agent or editor gets mm-hmm. a hold of it. I don't think on the marketing end, they're that afraid of it, so much afraid of it anymore. And I do think it's because of books like mine and you know, Laurie's and some of those that are becoming classics. You know, I mean, they really
yeah.
are. And so I'll just take Crank. I mean, Crank here, you would look at it and some people would open it up and look at verse and say, oh, it's too literary. And then some people will up and say, oh, but look how it's sold. It's too commercial. I think, you know, you just need, as far as writers go, as far as authors go, you just need to write the story the way it needs to be told. And I think that becomes an instinct. And I think every writer should not be afraid. They should never self-censor ahead of publication.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So an editor will tell you, you know, maybe that's a little bit too far or whatever, but I don't think you should self-censor in the writing process. I think you need to go full bore and write it just what you think the story needs to be. Because without that kind of passion for the storytelling, that's when I think they kind of fall flat.
Yeah, I agree.
It's nice to know that people can handle darker stories these days. I know that back in the early 2000s, some stuff was just, this is too dark. And they didn't really know where to put it. And I've just seen a lot of publishers who previously were, I guess, being conservative, really just take flight after, you know, stories like yours really found their audience.
Right, and I mean, there are books I read every now and again, and I'm like, whoa! Like, hey, really? Okay, I'll go for it. So, I mean, there are things that can feel very almost uncomfortable for me, but I'll keep reading them as long as the story is compelling and the characters, you know, are people I want to know about. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yes, Ellen Hopkins can be uncomfortable reading books too. Not too often, but once in a while.
Robin, do you want to take the next one?
What is the best interaction you've had with fans in letters, emails, or at events?
So I do a lot of outreach, book publicity too, but high school visits, library visits, you know, I try to be out where I can be available to my readers. And often, almost always when I do visits like that, high school visit, right? I'll do a big room and then the room will start clearing out and there'll always be one or two kids that wait, you know, and always those are kids that need to tell me a story, their story. Sometimes it's they want help, but usually it's just they want to know that someone will listen to their story without judging them. And that happens a lot. And so, and I get the same with emails. I mean, I literally, my email, Twitter, Facebook, Goodreads, Tumblr, you know, I have a big online presence. And so those messages come into me in the hundreds a day, 200 to 300 a day. And often, you know, if it's just like, I love your books, that's great too. But often they're telling me their stories or wanting me to write their stories. And I'm like, well, let's see how we can help you write your stories. But they often inspire my books. They really do. And one, and I think we'll talk a little bit in a minute maybe about the nonprofit that I've done.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But what really made me want to found a nonprofit to help some kids was I was doing a school visit in Truckee, California, which is often the coldest spot in the United States. And it was winter, and it was freezing cold outside. And I was in the library, and there was this one young man who he was asking great questions. He read all my books. You know, he just looked like any kid. And after everybody left and he left, the librarian told me that young man had been homeless for a year, living in the laundromat, sleeping in cars, or crashing with his friends when he could. And he was at school every single day because he was determined to graduate and find a way into college. And so, you know, that struck this huge chord in me that here's a young man whose circumstance has made homeless, but he cares enough about himself and the future, his own future, to make sure he's in school every day. That inspired me.
Yeah. So, as you've mentioned, your novels have shaped and changed the lives of untold readers, especially teenagers, and you are now taking this a step further with this new nonprofit organization, Ventana Sierra. Am I saying that correctly?
You know what? You're the first person that doesn't know Spanish that could pronounce Ventana correctly. They're always like, what is that? Ventana, which is window, right? Because my windows look to the Sierra, so that is where it came from. Yeah, so he inspired it. My younger daughter, Kelly, who was just on the phone, she has been in social work for 12 years. She was in Texas for a long time, lost her job, and moved back. And then first separately and then kind of together, we started talking about creating something for highly motivated at-risk kids. So maybe aging out of foster, they're on the street because their parents have kicked them out or they can't take care of them anymore. So kind of 17 to 25, we bring them into safe housing. We take them off the street, put them into safe housing and try to ascertain, you know, where they are educationally, get their GEDs for them if they need that, get them enrolled in college, put them on a forward-moving career track through higher education, the arts, mentorship, life skills. So it's been just about a year since we started planning it, and we opened our first house for girls 2 months ago.
Awesome.
And we're going to open our first house for boys before the end of the year, and then we'll have several more over the years and hopefully become a model program for other communities because these young people, a lot of them have no idea how to find the resources they need. If you age out of foster, they'll give you some money per month, but you have no idea how to spend that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or save money so you have some goals. And so, yeah, I'm really, really excited about it. It's been like the first girls in our house have been the bonding process, you know, for young women who haven't really had necessarily strong family situations to now come together as quote unquote sisters. And hasn't all been easy. I'm not saying that it has. Having to live with people you don't know is not an easy thing, but just amazing energy. And how great these kids are. You know, one of them who has a really, you know, a background of abuse, she wants to be a social worker, so that's her forward motion, you know, to help other kids who look like who she was 5 years ago. Teachers, they want to be teachers, they want to be construction management for the boys. You know, I mean, there are a lot of different ways we can go, because I think the way that we create a brighter future is maybe one life at a time.
Absolutely.
You know, it's every kid matters. Every kid matters. And we have to get to that. By helping one kid, when that kid moves on and starts helping other people, then we don't know how that's going to increase exponentially.
Right. Like the girl who wants to be a social worker, or the ones who want to be teachers, how many of them are they going to inspire to do the same?
Because someone has given them this chance, I think they're going to become really amazing people. I really do.
We talk a lot about how just writing something like this and just having these kinds of stories told can really affect people. But I think it's really kind of amazing that you're taking this next step and actually getting involved in this kind of direct way. I think that's really great.
Right. And it's, you know, like last night, two of our girls were having kind of meltdown. So I'm on Facebook, right? And I'm messaging one with her breakdown. Mm-hmm. On the other side with her meltdown. And so it's like, So Kelly is in the house every day making sure they get what they need, but it's because they come to me again because they feel safe with me.
Yeah.
So here I am like, okay, let's talk about the boyfriend and how we can fix that. On the other side, it's okay, let's talk about, you know, how you're going to do that, how you're going to accomplish that goal. And so it was a very late night. That's all right, too.
No, that's just awesome. You know, so many kids who are not at risk need things, but especially the ones who are, like you said, highly motivated, who still are, I guess, believing in themselves, to have other people step up and say, hey, you know what? I believe in you too. And I just can't even imagine how awesome that must be for them and for you guys, how rewarding.
And also, again, I hopefully that, you know, by us doing this, and so I'm, you know, being a fairly public figure and doing it, that, and I already have had two young women from, like, one was in Kansas and one was St. Louis or someplace. And they're like, I want to do this in my community. So tell me how to do it. I'm like, well, okay. It's a long process. It's political because, you know, nonprofit is very political.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have to get grant writing. I mean, you need money to, you know, to continue the program, and that part of it's not so much fun, but I'm happy to help anybody that wants to set up a similar program within their communities find the way in. Because, you know, and here's a statistic. Right now in this country, and this is going to be low because these are only the ones we know about. The ones we know about in this country right now, 60,000 teens under 18 have been on the street for 6 months or more.
Oh my God. Yeah, and that's just the ones reporting it.
Right. And a lot of them are there just, you know, they're kicked out. Their parents have kicked them out because they're gay. Mm-hmm. Or, yeah. You know, they ran away because they were abused or whatever. There are a lot of reasons why. Some of them are just turned out of juvenile detention for status violations, curfew violations, and their parents are like, well, if that's where you're going, bye-bye. And it does. It happens. And, you know, in this state alone, and by the way, our program is available to kids from across the country. So we've had applications from Michigan, from California, from Oklahoma, so it's not just a Nevada program, even though this is where our housing is, but just in Nevada, we have 1,000 kids homeless right now, you know? And on the streets of New York, 3,800 with 200 beds that they rotate them through.
Oh,
so it's a huge, huge problem, and we need to start looking for solutions as a community, you know, that whole idea of it takes a village, it takes a community, it takes, yeah. You know, a network of people who care. And I think we can create that. I really do. I believe that.
Absolutely. And if already that the program is inspiring other people to go through the long process of the nonprofit organization, you guys are setting up. Your ultimate goal was 5 houses for girls, 5 houses for boys?
Right. That's locally. So, yeah.
Yeah. Are there resources listed on the Ventana Sierra website?
There are. Anybody is welcome also just to email me. My email's easy to find. But it's great for people to go check out VentanaSierra.org, and they can see what we're doing with the girls. You know, I have a friend who's a visual artist. She came in and taught them to paint. So that we have, you know,
cool.
Just their paintings, beautiful paintings that they produced yesterday. Because I want an arts element too, because I believe the arts heal. Mm-hmm. You know, music, dance, theater, literature, those things are healing because they heal you inside. You know, we can heal the outside as far as feeding people and making sure they have a safe place to sleep. It's inside, it's the arts that heal.
You got to nurture the spirit. Well, Ellen, thank you so very much for joining us here today. Is there anything further you would like for folks to know about Smoke, about Ventana Sierra?
Smoke is out September 10th. You can pre-order it now, though. But I will say this about Smoke. Even though it was a book I didn't want to write, it ended up being one of my favorite books I've ever written. And I do think the continuation of Patton's story was, I think my readers are going to love what happens in the book. Not that it's not sad in places, of course. And I hope, you know, you'll enjoy Smoke. I really do. I'm writing the 2014 young adult, which is Rumble, which will be out September 14. That's about belief versus non-belief. I know. I'm gonna get it again.
You didn't learn from the first.
I'm gonna irritate the atheist in the crowd. I'm gonna irritate the religious in the crowd. It's about, you know, trying to meld those two worlds and find a way to meld those worlds, and it's not always easy to do that.
No. Yeah, and that's, you know, it's just as important a subject for teenagers as any of the other ones that you've tackled, like belief and figuring out what you believe. That's kind of huge in your teenage years. So.
Oh my God, yeah.
Right, and when I was interested in doing that because, you know, I'm fairly open with my political views on my Facebook page. pretty open. You'll know who I am when you go there and see what I post. But I made a post, and I come from, my background is Lutheran Presbyterian, you know, so I have a faith journey, I believe. But I had posted there had been those mosque burnings. There were two in a row, one in Tennessee and one in New York or something. Mm-hmm. And so I made a post that said, we all serve one creator, meaning Jew, Muslim, Christian, right? And this girl came up and she's like, it is awfully arrogant of you to believe that I have to have a belief. And I'm like, whoa, you're 16 and you are like so certain that there is nothing. That interested me because it seems like when you're a teenager is the time you should at least be looking for questioning stuff on either side, looking for answers, maybe some big answers. And she just was not interested in any kind of thing like that. I'm like, well, okay, this interests me. I have to write a book that has this in it. So I did. Then I'll go into the next adult book, which will be the first novel I've written. So I have two adult novels as well, also in verse. Tangled, which is a spring 15 book, will be in prose. It's about falling in love with a psychopath.
Wow.
The main character is not going to know if it's the man she falls in love with or his son who's the psychopath. But there will be poems from the point of view of the psychopath that will give you hints.
Interesting.
That sounds.
So I'm doing that. I'm adapting Crank to the stage. So I'm writing the script for that. And I'm doing Ventana Sierra. And if, you know, we can use any kind of donations, monetary, time, volunteerism, anything, even if it's just, you know, words of encouragement to the people in our houses, that would be awesome too, to say, you know, yes, I believe you can do it because they've been beaten down a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To let them know that we all believe in them. So, yeah.
Well, we'll definitely get Ventana Sierra and your website linked up on
absolutely
podcast so people can take a look and see if they can get involved or if they want to start one of their own. So
that'd be awesome.
Well, Ellen, thank you so much for taking time out of your, sounds like, extremely busy schedule to chat with us today. Good luck with everything, and readers, check it all out. Ellen's awesome.
Thanks.
All right. Have a good one.
You too. Thank Bye-bye. You. Bye.
So it's really great to see an author going out of her way to help her audience like that. It kind of restored a little of my faith in humanity.
There were people in my high school could have used a program like that. I like her. We should have her back. Actually, You should just let me talk to people who aren't you two more often.
It's true. You were very good.
I guess that means you win another month in the box? Aww. I'm kidding. All right. With that, I think it's time for our new and notable book recommendations. So for the month of August 2013, we here at Paper Cuts Podcast have chosen a trio of titles with male protagonists.
My pick is 8 by H.M. Castor. This possibly paranormal historical fiction is about one of the most fascinating kings England has had, Henry VIII.
I'm recommending Sunday You Learn How to Box by Bill Wright. Set in a 1986 housing project, it has a front and center LGBT plotline, and the protagonist is a young man of color. So, double diversity points for this YA.
And my pick is Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock by Matthew Quick. With a really intriguing blurb, it sounds like an intense take on the very topical issue of teenage suicide and gun violence.
Remember, with New and Notable, we've only read the blurbs. So if you give them a read, let us know what you thought.
Thanks for listening to Paper Cuts Podcast. The new site is papercutspodcast.com, and you can find us on Twitter at YAPaperCuts. You can find Ollie at oliviahennis.wordpress.com, Robin at robinconnolly.blogspot.com, and me at ykmreviews.blogspot.com. See you next time.